Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic, and I am super excited because the person I've got on this channel today, the person I'm sitting down with, is one of the most knowledgeable magicians that I know. He is an incredible performer. I have raved about his material on this channel over and over again. And I interviewed Dave Jones earlier, a few weeks ago, and I kind of thought to myself, how do I get somebody on the channel that's even more knowledgeable than Dave Jones? What do you do? You invite Sean McCree on. Sean, how are you? Are you okay?
Not bad, thank you. Not bad. I think like everybody else, we're going a bit mad now, but there we go. That's it, we're getting there.
Absolutely. And hopefully, like we just said off camera, hopefully we're going to be, we're seeing light at the end of the tunnel for the first time. We seem to be moving in the right direction. But I know, I've been speaking to you for a long time about doing this interview. You're actually one of the very first people that I reached out to, and I know you were busy at the time. And I've been trying to get you on the channel now for probably about 6 months since it started. You were one of the very first people I approached, and it's taken me a while to get you on here, but I'm so glad that you have, because I have so much respect for you as a performer and as a creator and as a cardician and a magician. And I think that people can learn so much from you. So thank you so much for finding the time to come on the channel.
Thanks for asking.
No problem. Now, I know I've got a big audience in America, and I'm willing to bet there's a few people that are watching this that don't know who you are. And I aim to fix that because, you've done so much in your career. You really have. And you're so well read, which we can see from the books behind you. And you know, when we started this call, I was like, oh, that's a fantastic backdrop. And you went, yeah, that's one of the shelves. Like, I just imagine your house just being, well, everyone else uses wallpaper, you use magic books.
Not just magic books, but you're pretty close there. Yeah, we're in grave danger of the house collapsing into a black hole under the weight of books, I think. It's close to doing that now.
And that's just amazing to see. It really is. But let's... The people that don't know who you are, Sean, before we start talking about advice and books and everything else, let's start at the very beginning. You've been in magic for a very long time. When I came into magic, everybody was talking about Sean McCree. So you've been around a lot longer than I have. How did you get into magic? What's your origin story? Is it your typical pull a coin from behind your ear?
I grew up in a village in the middle of nowhere, basically, and there was hardly any kids around. And then when I was seven, I had an accident at school that injured my eye. And I was in hospital for 3 weeks. And because my dad was a GP, one of the consultants that came around, they used to come in and check on me because, you know, I was just there all the time. And he came and showed me that X-ray eyes card trick thing, which I thought was quite appropriate because I couldn't see out of one eye, and left me the deck of cards to play with. And then at the same sort of time, I think I got the Norman Hunter, the Puffin magic book, and the John Fisher magic book for one Christmas. But I had a year when I wasn't allowed to do any kind of sports or PE or gym or anything like that at school. So I kind of, that was like between that and then summer holidays where I didn't get to see any of the kids for a long time because my brothers were quite little at that point. That was kind of the perfect thing for an introverted sort of a hobby like magic, really. And I started doing it quite intensely then, really. And then I remember seeing, my dad took me to the one and only Preston convention in 1974, and I spent some pocket money. And then I did the first competition that I did would have been 1977, and that was by accident because we went to the Northern Magic Circle convention, and they did have a junior club, and I was doing one of the junior shows. Most of them were based in the Northeast and I wasn't, so I just went along and did the show. And they said, look, we've had somebody drop out of the competition, would you come back and do the same act tomorrow in the competition? So my dad went, yeah, I guess we can sort that. So we drove back over, I did the same act, came sort of runner up, and that kind of settled it for holidays for many years. Became we're going to Brussels because that's where Sean's competing, that sort of thing. It was, I just carried on doing it.
And you've won a lot of competitions, obviously, through your career.
Few.
Yeah, quite a few. More than a few. A hell of a lot. What advice have you got for somebody who was wanting to enter competitions? Well, first of all, actually, before you ask that, let me ask you a question. What was your reason for entering competitions? Because a lot of people, they enter competitions because they want to appear better in their marketing publicity. I'm an award-winning magician, but you were entering when you were younger.
Yeah, I was.
So what's your reason?
As a teenager. I don't know. It became something of an obsession, really. And then as I started to, and then when I saw Gare Copper do his act, and I saw Brian Sefton. It was a friend that took me to see him work, and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to be a manipulator. That's absolutely what I want to do. So that became something of an obsession, really. And that was the first time I did the IBM Shield was that. I was supposed to be at Freshers Week for university, but instead I was Great Yarmouth competing. And then it became, I was driven to do it, really. And then I started doing different competitions in different ways. The first time I would go into a competition, I would go to experience it and feel what it was like, to know how to go back and then do it again properly the next time. You know, and so it was the case, with the one exception being the international close-up ones, because you could buy the videos in those days. You could buy the VHS tapes of previous years, so you had a good idea of what to go in for it for. But I just thoroughly enjoyed doing it, and it just in the same way as I enjoy, you know, obviously you want to win, but there was a whole sort of group of us really that did the stage competitions in Britain at that time that all became really good mates. Yeah. And you kind of, as long as one of you won, didn't really matter, you know. Didn't matter to me. I came second, and Neil Roberts had won, or I'd come, you know, second, and Mistina had won, or something. Because everybody knew everybody else, and it was great fun. And so we became this sort of little clique of performers, really. And then we ended up, by the same token, obviously ended up doing the society dinners and the smaller convention shows and some of the gala shows and all those sorts of things. And it just became a way of life, really. And then eventually you run out of competitions in this country and move abroad and that sort of thing, you know.
So what, going back to the original question, what advice would you give somebody who's wanting to enter competitions?
Find out as much about the competition as you can first. Mm-hmm. Know what it is you're going in for. There are, you know, in competition magic isn't the same as real magic. It's not real world magic in the slightest bit. You need to have, I reckon, for a competition, you need to have an act. Not like we would normally go out and do. When you're working for 10 minutes to a group of people, you, I don't even necessarily know exactly what I'm going to do till I start. But, when I did the going for that, the closer pack, when I did the coin act, which I did at FISM in 91 and St. Louis, I think I did the Gold Cups competition there in 1990. And that was all sort of themed with clocks and watches all the way through it. So there was running gags of, I'm just going to keep an eye on the watch, because I put it down there, and then just another watch appears, and I'm just going to keep an eye on the watch and put it down there. Can you keep an eye on the clock for me? I'll put it here next to the watches, and just produce these rows and, you know, clocks and watches. And at the end, it was just to make sure I'm okay with the time, there's a giant wristwatch appears, sort of thing. So it was all themed as an act. Mm. It wasn't pieces. And it wasn't remotely like, some of the bits might have been effects I would do for real people, but the thing itself wasn't. And of course, because I did sort of stage manip acts, they were really tied in entirely to the music when I did those. They were exactly the same. I think for those, if you're doing an act like that, you need to watch Fred Capps and see it. Perfect. Fred Capps, Jeff McBride. And I think the perfect competition act is probably Soma's Telephones.
Oh, it's brilliant. I think
that's everything about that is perfect. And that's what you need to do. You need to watch all those acts, which is much easier now than it ever used to be. I used to wear VHS videotapes almost completely out, watching Norm Nielsen and Jeff McBride and Lance Burton. But I think that's what I'd be saying is, you don't think of it as tricks the way that we normally would do in the real world. It's an act. It's an actual complete act that you do over and over and over again, and put in extra little linking bits and extra bits of magic that are, just to tie it all together and make it feel more sort of cohesive, really.
Do you think you need a moment in the act that's kind of makes magicians go, whoa? So taking Soma, for example, you've got that moment where he's tearing the newspaper and then he kind of has that moment where he reverses in time and the newspaper restores and then the piece flies up and restores as well. You know, everyone does a torn and restored newspaper, but that's a way of doing it that made every single magician watch it the first time they saw it. They were like, whoa. Do you think you need something like that in a competition?
I think it certainly helps if you're going to stand a chance of winning. There's finding those things is sometimes not easy though. You sometimes you start with that and come round about it. And then when we did the Enchanted Garden Act, that was a long time ago, it was the late 80s, and I originally set it out to be so that when we were, because I was aiming to do FISM a few years later, and when we set it out, what I didn't want was an act that you could write up as did coins, cards, billiard balls, because that's what everybody gets written up as. So it then became flower petals and roses and all that sort of thing, and tied it all together with a theme for that. Same stuff. It's still cards and billiard balls, and you know, but no different. But it looked different.
Yeah.
And so I was starting to shape it at that point, and then we kind of went, no, what we really need is a theme to this, and that's when it came with the girl production at the end, which I think everybody kind of figured that, you know, if you've got a girl assistant, she's going to be on stage, not hidden out of the way until the very last moment to appear out of nowhere, out of thin air, as a shock end. And that kind of, I think that was part of what won some of the awards with that act, because it was unexpected. It rounded off the act completely from, you know, it started with the starting point right the way around to the finishing point. Whether you need to fool magicians is another question altogether. I think it does help if you can, because it's not like doing magic for real people. Real people will just go, when a billiard ball changes colour, you know, it's not, magicians don't. I used to do a jumbo coin star, and it was a nightmare to do. And you'd hear literally about, in when you did a competition, about three places in the audience would applaud, and that's three other people that have tried it. The other people that have never tried it don't know how hard it is and why it's worth applauding. It was one of those sort of things, you know, that you get that. If you can do, I think, if you do sleight of hand, making it look that you're doing harder sleight of hand than you are actually doing is a good idea. Mm. That gains you brownie points. But then that backfires the other way. I remember seeing Leonard Green not getting the award because they couldn't believe it was.
Yeah, I remember.
They thought it was Stooges. And it was like, you know. No. So, yeah. I think it does help if you can get a moment, or everything is just like, either you need a moment or you need it all crafted together so it all just ties in on itself. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes going full circle, ending up exactly where you began is a nice round sort of finishing way to put a competition act together. But the thing is that you're in such a bizarre circumstance anyway that you don't know who you're going to be following, who's going to be on after you. So ideally, you want to be different. You want to look different and seem different from the others, you know.
Yeah. And do you have any advice in terms of when you're doing a competition, in terms of performing for magicians? Because, I mean, you've made a career out of performing for magicians, both as a lecturer, as a creator, and also as a competition, you know, a competition act. There's people that are going to be watching this that are thinking, oh, my God, the thought of performing in front of magicians just petrifies me.
I suppose because I started out doing it, it's never occurred to me that as an issue. You know, it was just... And I just used to get asked to do beyond the shows because I had that kind of an act, you know. Magicians are weird to perform for. They'll applaud things that they didn't see you do but know you must have done. And they'll applaud something you haven't done yet because of the way you got into it so well. Mm. You know, they'll go, oh, that was the most perfect steal from wherever it was. And they start to applaud before you've done anything. They're not like real people. You sort of get into the feel of performing for magicians, really. But it's a very limited market in some ways. Really.
Well, it is. But I mean, like you said yourself, I mean, you had an act that you literally went around the world with. You know, and that is a viable performing space, really, isn't it? You know, if you've got an act, people are people have seen the act, you've won competitions with it, you've performed it, you can get invited to gala shows literally all over the world to perform.
Well, it was when I got the proper version, rather than the more competition-y versions of the act, but the proper version of the act, which unfortunately I don't have a video of, I was able to work that in commercial venues abroad. But that was when a 10-minute visual act was exactly what you needed to use at the time, you know, and that's you'd do it twice a night in a nightclub, you know, and that was great. And because you're in a little enclosed bubble, there's no interaction with other people, they just watch. So that was commercial then. Whether it is as commercial now, I don't really know. It's hard to tell. I don't really know what the overlap is between magicians and commercial magic. It's probably different these days. Nowadays, I would think what I do for everything I do for magicians these days, when I've done things, performances and competitions, has been what I do for real people.
Yeah.
So it's not the same thing, because it's been a show rather than a competition, really, mostly, apart from doing Blackpool a few years ago.
Well, you know, there's going to be people that know you or are aware of your career and your body of work that are watching this. And they're probably going to be a little bit surprised that you're bringing up the term manipulator, because everybody knows you as an incredible close-up magician.
That was by accident. Really? Because when I was, you know, but like, so I was, when I switched to doing the teaching degree, I was a teaching student. So I was still doing kids shows. A lot of those, because I've been doing them since about 11, really, anyway. So I just carried on. I would come home at weekends and do a couple of kids shows and pay for, you know, my place at college. And then during the summertime, so I did a summer in Zurich with Alan Shackson and Joe Marble was on that, I think, Emerson and Jane. We did a summer run there. And then the following year, I went back to Switzerland and did a run in the Pussycat Salon in Geneva, which was very educational when I was a student, let me tell you. Being one of only two acts that remained clothed for the entire night. But that was what I was doing. And I expected to go when I went for, because basically when I got to, I qualified, all my tutors kind of going, yeah, we see you're not applying for teaching jobs then, Sean. No, I said, no, well, I'm going to give this a go for a year and see how we get on. And I was expecting to do kids shows and like sort of the end of the pier type shows and the hardy camps and that sort of thing. But that coincided in 86 with that was when those shows started to wind down. They were getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And because I knew the close-up guys from doing competitions, I'd chatted with John Hatauka the year before at the convention. So I was getting some idea of what this was about, the close-up magic, but I didn't, apart from doing a few tricks from mates at college, I didn't have anything commercial at all, really. So I sort of fell into it by accident. And there was so little to find in the press in this country at that time. There was only a handful of us really doing it. So you kind of learned on your feet, really. And I think, and I know Dave mentioned Cafe Josie the other week, that was a turning point for a lot of us, really. I've been doing the sort of close-up for a couple of years by then, but then we were all learning together in the same place at the same time, and it made a huge difference to all of our sort of performing styles. So I came in with, you know, basic sort of close-up skills. I learned the advanced close-up skills along with the guys like Dave Jones and Pete Clifford and Dave Allen and these others. When everything was David Roth material, and we were all just... We would perform Paul Harris for people, and David Roth is what we performed for each other. But I had a huge gap in the middle of stuff that I simply didn't have knowledge about and didn't know any experience of, and I had to kind of learn that gradually as I went along. It was purely by chance. I never intended to be a commercial close-up person at all.
But it was just adapting to the
We ended up sort of with. I fell into following. Because at the time everything was booked through agents. That was what you did. You got on the books of a few agents, and I was on the books of about a dozen, 18 agents. And some of them had stayed on the same agent for many, many years. But that's what the work was. So they would book me to do kids shows, and then I would need some sort of stand-up shows. And then it would be, oh, can you do these? And I was doing Bass Party Nights. Because Joe Ryden started them earlier on in about the early 80s doing those. And some of the other performers were doing a stand-up show in the pubs, you know, And then some of us were starting to do a bit of close-up. So I'd kind of learned, I was learning on my feet with doing all that. And then it just became, that was more workable. And then when we got, and I kind of moved, and I moved from the Bass Nights to the Thwaites Nights that then Joe had moved off from, which also meant I had to learn cold reading because that was on the posters anyway, because he'd been doing fortune telling. So, because they said, oh, can you do this character? And I yeah. Yeah. I ain't got a clue what I was doing. So I used to, I went for numerology because I could have a clipboard and I could have a crib sheet in the clipboard. So I didn't have to remember it all. But it was when we got to Cafe Josie and we started working in teams that it made a difference, I think, because there were enough of us to go out and do the big events. And it was novel. Nobody had any idea. I remember trying to sell it into restaurants and they were kind of go, well, what do you, we can't really have things like doves and rabbits. And no. Well, would you set it up in the corner and do the show there? No, it's not like that. And to remember now that you had to explain to people what commercial close-up magic actually was a really weird thing to think about it now that everybody, you know, that now it's more likely that people will kind of go, how do you do a stand-up show? Than explaining to the client what close-up magic actually was. And that was quite fascinating.
There's going to be people that are going to be watching this. And they probably can't even comprehend that because these days it's completely reversed, isn't it? Mm. When you get into magic, you get into close-up magic and then eventually you aspire to perform on stage. But back in the day, that wasn't the case. I remember when I first got into magic, I saved up and saved up. And one of the first things I got was a chair suspension. I had nowhere to do it, but that's what I wanted that. I needed it. My plan was always to perform on stage. And
yeah.
It's weird how that's completely changed around now.
Yeah. One of the agents that I worked for in Manchester for a long time couldn't conceive of the idea of having a magician at a wedding. So I did his daughter's wedding for free. And then he kind of went, oh, I see how it works now. And at that point in time, he would never have booked anybody to do magic at a wedding. They just couldn't understand that it was a possibility. Mm. You know, and so I started doing like local dinners. I'd be doing maybe, you know, stand up as part of the dinner in the evening. I'd say, well, I'll just go around, I'll do something at the tables as well first, you know, like local rotaries and things like that. And they go, well, what? I'll just pop around and do a few tricks at each of the tables. Well, okay, if you have to, sort of thing. And the venue I used to do for Christmas, it started out with, can you do, right, what, a kids' party, can you do that? And then the next year, can you do the kids' party and can you come in and do the evening on Christmas Eve as well? And then, can you do, we're not having a kids' party anymore. Can you do lunchtime Christmas Eve and the evening Christmas Eve? And then can you do Boxing Day as well? Can you do New Year's Eve? And I think I was there for 28 years over the course of the time. But it just all evolved as it just changed. And it's quite fascinating to me. And it's changing again now. What I find fascinating is when people say, well, I haven't done any of the Zoom show, but you know, what sort of material that I do in a Zoom show? And I'm kind of thinking, well, what I would have done on stage before I started doing close-up.
Yeah.
That's the point. It's that sort of thing, you know. So it's intriguing to me how it's all.
And things will change. I think that virtual shows will stick around. I think it's going to be another option. You know, like some people put on the website, I do kids shows, I do cabaret, I do illusion shows, I do close-up. It's going to be, I do virtual shows.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember doing when the first trade show that I did was 1990, I think. And there weren't any rules covering what the performers were and what they could do because there weren't any. It just didn't happen. You know, I mean, there was half a dozen people might have been doing it in this country, and the chances of you ever running into another one at a trade show was almost nil. Mm. And again, I fell into that sort of partially by accident, really, and ended up doing exhibitions for years. Partially because the other half of one of the agents that I worked for made the exhibition stands, and then he moved into designing the stands and helping coach people how to use the stands, and basically built me and my colleague John into the stands. Mm. So it was so we did trade shows for years, and that was another one by accident, really. I mean, because looking for, you know, when you try and find what was in print about it, there was nothing, you know, and that wasn't a market at all. I think there might have been a handful of people like Michael Bailey and stuff doing it, but hardly anybody in this country. It was a big business in the States, but not here.
Mm. I want to talk about that in a minute. Let me ask you one other question. Do you think that learning stage magic and stage manipulation before you started learning close-up magic made you a better close-up magician. And the reason I ask this is because I see a lot, I've been to a lot of multi-man gigs where they're booked to do banquets and they walk over to a table of 10 and they'll perform to two or three people. They won't perform to the whole table. And everybody I've seen that does, in my opinion, table magic or banquet magic correctly, they've got a background or they've performed on stage because you kind of walk over and you own the whole table. Do you think it's important to have stage skills as a close-up magician?
Important? Maybe not. An asset, probably. It does mean you think differently when you're doing that sort of material. One of the things I learned very quickly, partially because I was doing the pubs following Joe, but partially also because at the same time I was doing like Michelin star places where there was no space on the table because there was 97 glasses in front of every person, and you know that you, everything's worked up here. And I know that Michael Amar, when I saw him lecture, was saying things like that you want things framed up here with you in your face so they can see you, and everything's done chest height and up here, not packet tricks down here where nobody can see it. But I think it's not. Again, that's something that came about with the trade shows. You learn very quickly to transition from two people to four people to 10 people to 40 people. And you just kind of sort of step up and back and get sort of more stand-up, I think. Mm. I don't know. It's probably an asset. Whether it's a requirement, I doubt very much. I think, you know, you can learn in either direction, I would reckon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was automatically the way we all did, because when pocket tricks were pocket tricks, they didn't conceive of being done at an event like that. So everybody went, and you'll see it sometimes at Magic Society dinners, when the members go around and do tricks at tables instead of the performers going around doing tricks at tables. They do a pocket trick they do for two people in a pub.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rather than something that the entire table can see and something that's up off the table and visible for everybody.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a good question, though.
Mm, it's interesting, isn't it? What advice, as somebody who's done stage for years and close-up for years, a question I get on this channel an awful lot is, how do I transition from a close-up magician into a stage magician? What skills do I need to learn? And also, how do I cope with the nerves of performing on stage? Because, you know, there's a big difference between walking out cold in front of 200 or 300 people and walking up to a group of 5 people in a pub.
Yeah. That's kind of a difficult one for me to answer, really, because I didn't do that. I didn't transition that way around. So I just stepped back into what I used to do. You do need to think differently. I think the way you script things is different. I think when you're doing, like my after dinner stand-up is pretty tightly scripted. It feels relaxed and there's bits in it where I'm apparently corpse because somebody's made me laugh and all that, but it's in the same place every time, and the timing's the same every time. Because if you talk like that when you're performing in close-up, you sound like a robot. You just sound like you're on a script in a machine. You can have a script, but it'd be one that goes in different directions and you can deviate from. And like I say, sometimes, particularly in a private party, I don't know what I'm going to do until I start doing it. And I don't think the stand-up isn't like that at all. You need... There's a different level of confidence, I think, that comes up as stand-up in front of hundreds of people. I don't know, really. It must be a lot more difficult to transition upwards than it is from stage to close-up, I would think.
Yeah.
The nerves is something, you know, I mean, I used to... doing the competition acts, because I used to be found on stage, and there's always that moment where the music started or the announcement's gone, or whatever, before the curtains open, and that moment when your butterflies go in your stomach because it's too late. You've started. You can't run, you know. Even though you can't see yet, the curtains are about to open. And I think if you lose that entirely, you lose the edge. You know, you lose the intensity. I don't know. Then again, I trained as a teacher, so standing up in front of people, you know, in front of a hall full of kids and talking to the back of the room was normal, you know. Mm-hmm. So I suppose, again, it's all kind of fed into the same thing. You know, I'd been doing it as a performer for years, and then I did it as a teacher, and there's no different. And so it's very little different when you're doing a lecture or when you're doing one of these corporate promo things or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got to the point in your career now where you've moved sort of not from stage to close up, but you've now got two strings to your bow and you've been performing at a very high level since then. I mean, literally, you've never been short of work. You know, you've always performed at a very high level. I want to talk about creativity in a bit, and I want to talk about, you know, the tricks that you've released and things that you've done. But before I do, one thing that struck me about you that you don't see with many close-up magicians, and I'm talking specifically about close-up now, is that you do card magic and coin magic at a very high level. A lot of people, they'll dabble with one or just focus, like look at Paul Gordon, he just does card magic, and most people are like that, but you've performed at a very high level with both cards and coins. Was there a reason behind that?
That's a good question. Again, I think that probably goes back to in the Minipack days, because unlike, I mean, nowadays when you see many of the Far Eastern performers, they'll do literally a card manipulation act and that's all they'll do, and they'll do techniques that are way beyond anything I could possibly conceive of doing. But there was a format that we sort of had that was the standard thing. And if, again, look at Brian Sefton's act, which is a perfect example. It used to be you'd do three different kinds of manipulation, more or less. So I settled on jumbo coins, cards, and billy balls. Other bits and pieces around it, but basically that. I could sort of do thimbles, but, you know, didn't really. And then something else like the rings or a zombie or, you know, whatever, that floating ball, something of that sort. And that was kind of the normal way. So it wasn't... When I did competitions for magicians doing the close-up, once I'd settled into a format, I did coins. Probably, again, as I say, that's the David Roth influence, really, at the time, because that was the cutting-edge stuff that we were doing at that point, and I just found that fascinating. And things like the tuning fork just set me off as a perfect piece of wonderful magic. I didn't really do card magic for magicians in quite the same way then, but then the practicality of doing it, and again, that'll be the pubs and the restaurants, because that's one prop, one piece of pocket space. So the more things you can do with it, the better. But I'm fascinated with the cheating techniques and things like that anyway. So, I just like to learn things. And, you know, I can't do all the things I used to be able to do, but I just enjoy learning sleights, really. I don't like things that work themselves. I don't like props a lot, I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's why, hence, you know, cards and coins and elastic bands, things, you know, the props everybody uses.
Absolutely. And you've mentioned David Roth quite a few times through the through this interview. Would you say he was a big influence on your career or on the style of magic that you... the reason I asked that is because I remember learning and performing for many years your version of Roth's Portable Hole, which is... As much as I love Roth's Portable Hole, and I do love Roth's Portable Hole, yours is infinitely more practical for a real world situation.
I think that's a fair observation. Is that I think his stuff is some of the most magical coin magic you can have for a formal performance for magicians or for the castle. But in the real world, you can't do that, and that's something I've spent a long time doing with a lot of the stuff that I do. I don't necessarily create something brand new. What I'll do is I'll get an idea that I think is fascinating. And the portable hole, I just love the portable hole. I think as a concept, it's just genius. So I thought, well, why? I'm never going to get to perform this for real people. So I went away and worked out something that is the same hook and the same feel and the same idea, but is a workable effect. And doesn't need a table, and you know, you can do it with borrowed coins and so on and so forth. So that's what I've done with a lot of stuff, is I've kind of gone, this is a great effect, but as it stands, it's unworkable for me in the real world. So I'll go away and I'll work out a way that makes it workable. You know, same with things like the razor blade deck. You know, I like the idea of the fact that the spectators can reset that for you. You know, as most of the versions of it aren't practical in reality. Where if they're in a position where they can reset it, and you can go back in your pocket and you can go to the next table and do it again if you want. I became very conscious of early on, I don't think reset was an important thing. No. We didn't realize it. I don't think most of what was published wasn't in any concept of resetting. And that became really significant when I started to move to the banquets and things. Because, you know, if you're doing, if you've got a minute and a half reset and you've got 20 tables to do, you know, that's thick end of half an hour off your 2 hour time, just resetting. So that's why I look at stuff and come up with other ways of doing it, preferably that have no reset at all. And ideally have everything goes back in the pockets where it started. It ends up in the same place, because there's nothing worse than going for that important gimmick to find that it's in your back left trouser pocket and you've only got your right hand available to get to it because you've got to reset it. But yeah, I mean, David Ross magic is beautiful, and I still, there's some things I would still like to do the sleeve. I would, at some point, I would love to find an excuse to do the sleeve routine. But I never found a way to make that work in any kind of practical way. I did try to do it in sort of a parlour setting at one time, but I couldn't, it just didn't kind of, didn't gel. Yeah. But I think, go on. I was going to say, as far as magic for magicians is concerned, yes, David Ross, a massive influence, I think, at that time.
Well, how do you go around, what's your process for taking a trick and making it your own? And using the portable hole as an example, this is something that hundreds of magicians, thousands of magicians have read, practiced, learned the impasse, learned everything that you need to learn in order to perform it flawlessly, and then ultimately never gone out and done it because they then go into an environment which it's never practical for. You then took it and said, well, actually, I love this premise, I love this hook. How can I make it so that I keep that and yet make it work for the environment I'm in? And I think that's something that magicians struggle with, making a trick their own. And it's something I've seen you do over and over again. Have you got any advice on your process?
Yeah, well, I start with the performing conditions, invariably. Like I say, you know, when I first started, I didn't realise that you weren't going to be in a position where you couldn't put things down. You know, because if you're in a pub somewhere, you don't put a deck of cards on the table because it's just going to stick to it. It's not going to come up off the table. You don't have any space to put anything. I remember seeing a thing, I think it's in Davenport sold years ago. I mean, it was sold as a close-up mat that had like a cushion underneath that you could put down on top of people's cutlery on the table. And I'm thinking, no, just no. But I think it's also because I worked in so many different environments that you don't have the same tables. You don't have the same table space. You don't have the same visibility. You don't always have the, you know, I mean, some like American diners, you'll have a formica covered plastic top table or steel top tables in a pub, and then in a there's no space at all on a table. So everything comes up off the table first of all, is my consideration. So if I can't do it in my hands, I won't work. So I'll rework it so it can be done in your hands. That's my first criteria. Then the second one is it has to be practically no reset. So I'll work that into it. And then so you sometimes get defeated and you just can't come up with a solution to it. And it just sits in the back of your mind for ages, you know. And I've got routines that don't fit that bill at all from the early days that are, you know, and I've got some that I just work out for myself. I've got a progressive coin matrix, which is completely, utterly useless in the real world. But it was just a challenge to make. So I think taking other people, I just look at other people's effects and I go, well, if I like the idea, if I like the plot and I like the premise, then I'll work out some way to make it, some similar version of it work in reality. And that's kind of also how I wouldn't say the folded rising card came about a different way, really. That came about because everybody else in Cafe Josie was doing invisible deck and I didn't have a spare pocket. So I wanted a way to do invisible deck without an invisible deck. And that had the same, it's the same, it's not about, that's more an excuse to use the byplay of the invisible card and the invisible deck and have an impressive end to it rather than it being an actual invisible deck. But I wanted, because people would say, can you do that one with the invisible cards? Because I saw Dave Smith do it last week, you know. Yeah, well, mine's a bit different, but yeah. And that's the way some of these things come about. But I do think it helps if you can look at every version of something before you start to, you know, if you get a plot, sometimes I'll go for a plot that I haven't got in the repertoire, because I don't like overlapping too many things against one another being the same. So if I haven't got a plot, I'll find a way to make one work of that plot if I like it enough. And I'll, it'll fit my, you know, working criteria. And then I'll try it and see whether it works, and we're going to go out and perform it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. The main thing is you just got to do it over and over again for people until it gets right. That's what it comes down to. It just will improve. It just you start out with an idea. And I think this is one of the key things for me has always been is that I start out with a script with lines lifted from other routines. And by the time I've done it 40 or 50 times, people have said things to me that replace those lines gradually, bit by bit. And they give me a new script for that particular effect.
And that's all about listening to your audience and being prepared to adapt, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the things I'm really passionate about is the fact that, because I tend to find I'll chat with people a lot, you know, weddings and private parties and things. You just stand around chatting, because people have never seen a real magician that close, so they start asking you questions. And I reckon if enough people ask the same question, what's your favourite trick? What's the hardest trick you do? What's the first trick you learned? If people ask these questions, the same questions over and over again, they're basically telling you that's a hook for a routine.
Mm.
So I'll go, okay, so you want to know what's the first trick I learned? So I'll assign a trick to that plot because you're going to ask it to me. Another time I'm at another party, somebody's going to say, what's the first trick you learned? So I've got one. It's not remotely anything to do with the first trick I ever learned. But if they all say it, they give me that hook. They've given me that plot hook. So I'll tie a routine to it. And a lot of the stuff I've done in recent years has been, that's exactly what I started out doing. I've taken the hook, the setup first that they've given me, and I've made it into a routine that then I can adapt something else to work to.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I'm very passionate about. If they ask you the question over and over again, then they're telling you they want to know. So why not show them rather than tell them?
And I think that's something that a lot of magicians forget about, understanding that one of the most important things is the hook, is grabbing people's attention.
Mm.
You know, how many times have we pulled out a deck of cards and go and pick a card and they go, I know that one.
Because that's
the tomb, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've only got one chance to create a first impression. You need to grab them straight away, right?
I think so. I think, and the thing, there's a bizarre thing about card magic that allows you to do something odd, in that sometimes the procedure itself of the effect can be the hook. You know, so I have one where I'm going to find your card. The first card I'll find with two hands, the second card with one hand, and the third card with no hands. And then I've got another one, which is, so I want you to take out a card, but I want you to just look at a card, and I want you to just think of a card. So it gets progressively more difficult. And so you've kind of got a premise by the nature of the construct. No, there wouldn't be a first, an initial trick that I would do. It's one later on, but the construct of the routine actually gives you the hook. On the other hand, I do like the idea of claiming something absolutely impossible and then doing it, you know. So I'm going to find your card by holding the deck in one hand, cutting the card with the same hand that's holding them, reaching into the cut with two fingers of the hand doing the holding and the cutting, pulling out one card, all of which whilst completely blindfold, and then taking my glasses off. And then actually doing that and actually doing what you said, because they just think you're having a laugh with them, you're not going to do it. But then if you actually do what you just said you are going to do, this completely impossible thing, you've got a very compact piece of presentation there, I think. I like doing things like that. That's quite fun.
I have to say, I'm going to just completely go off topic a little bit, slightly. You mentioned and glossed over the folded invisible rising card. I have to say that if people are watching this and they are not aware of your work, Sean, they need to figure out a way to learn that trick, and they need to immediately buy it. I think that your DVD set is still available from RSVP.
It will be in the book.
And we're going to talk about the book. That was a game changer when I learned that. I use that in so many routines.
Yeah.
I do it in my multiple selection. I do it in a rising card thing as an extra rise. I do it as you presented it. I probably overuse that thing. And the reason I do is because there's very little that I have found that is commercial as that moment when you can be completely surrounded.
Yeah.
And they've gone through the pantomime of the folding up of the card, which is hilarious anyway. And then they get that moment where it just comes up out the deck.
Yeah.
Jaws drop. Like,
yes.
It is incredible. Out of everything that you've ever created, Sean, I have to say, it's so good.
They do freak out completely. It's something I can't quite get why it took me to do it. You know what I mean? Because the idea, I think the idea is a Harry Reiser one, from what I remember. And I remember seeing a version of it in a Linkin Ring parade, Rich Bartram, I think. But it just didn't come about in a way that connected. It just didn't fit. Plus, it wasn't quite as impromptu and as sort of easygoing. But it's just it's what I've probably done it more than most. I'll tell you what else. If there's when occasionally, you know, when you go just occasionally, those of us that do put stuff out into the magic community, you'll be at an event somewhere and somebody will say, "Oh, yeah, I saw a magician and he did this particular trick." And that's the one I get the most buzz out of when I hear that somebody, and he did this thing where I imagined I'd folded up a card and it came rising out of the deck. And I'm kind of going, oh, that's, I'm so chuffed now. That really made me feel pleased. But I think I've done that. I've done it on trade stands. I've done that because, as you say, it's actually quite a big trick.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it for quite a large group of people and it plays really well. And that moment as it rises about the deck is a really, it is a one that people just go, oh.
It really is. But it's the whole build-up, the structure of the routine before it. It's like, pick a card. Oh, no, don't let me see. Oh, I saw it. It's the blah, 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 blah. But the whole thing is just, it's one of the most commercial routines I know. With the
thank you.
And it's a Fastidio, isn't it? It's a shuffle deck in use anytime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even better.
I do. I have to say that's something I do go by as much as I possibly can. I've nothing against gimmicks in a deck of cards. I'm just too lazy to ring them in and out. And I'm more likely to do the routine more often if I can do it from a shuffle deck. So it'll get more working in and it'll end up with it to a place where I'm happier with it.
Mm.
And then sometimes they'll drop out of the repertoire for a bit and I'll put them back in again later on, you know. But it's, but that one is yeah. So I'm having to replace the card. That's that's one of the ones I'm more proud of. That one and the coins through the slot in the card. That's the, I like that.
Yeah, that's so much amazing material. You really have. Have you got any advice on actually approaching people? Because obviously you're an expert when it comes to mix and mingle. And I've said on this channel over and over again, the thing that a lot of magicians gloss over is, and that, you know, it's not about the opening trick. It's about actually going up to a group of people and get a group of people that are deep in conversation and you have to interrupt them and get them to like you enough to want to see magic.
Yeah,
that's the most difficult thing, and that's when we learn magic. We don't learn about that. We learn about okay, did you drop a red pen knife? No. How about a white pen knife? Whatever it may be.
Yeah.
But really, it's more about the ability to be able to get these complete strangers to want to actually spend time with you.
I think there's a some of that comes from reading the people. You know, it's like you learn in the restaurants that if you got your back to the table, you're invisible. So you can listen to what's going on at the table and you kind of go, that's, I'm there, they're in the middle of conducting a business deal. I don't go anywhere near that one, you know, and things like that. And so that starts it. And then when you're doing, I think it's the first group that you go up to, particularly if you're doing like, you know, cocktails before dinner sort of thing, it pays to take a few minutes to read the room a bit first and look around, see what kind of groups they're in. See what kind of groups are enjoying themselves and see what kind of groups are approachable. And when you get one that's open, where there's a gap and it's open, it's much easier to approach than one that's tightly closed in and everybody's kind of shoulder to shoulder. But there are a lot of times on those, I'll kind of, if you're brandishing a deck of cards these days, they'll go, oh, it's a magician. And you go, well, sorry, well, I come to you. Somebody's got to be first. And you go and do that group and once they laugh, you're away. Which that didn't used to be the case. You did have to use the sneaky techniques to a certain extent to get in, you know. I used to use the paper to money all the time for that. But it's just about... Have you done one of these with Harry?
Harry Robson?
Yeah.
Not yet, no. I'm going to. But
I'm
going to
tell you, and the best I have ever seen, we did the dinner for a psychopharmaceutical conference... And we were just about to start the first group of people before dinner drinks. And Harry goes, right, takes the deck of cards, walks up to the people, puts the cards in his pocket, proceeds to talk about his blood pressure and statins for 10 minutes. And then just start entertaining them by talking to them. That's the point. It's just because he's Harry. You know, it's got nothing to do. If you were at a party and you walk up to a group of people and you're going to just go and talk to them anyway, you're not necessarily going to do a trick, you know. And it's kind of the same. You need them to like you as a person quite quickly. quite how you do that, I think, just comes with time, really. I think you also don't. The other thing is, you can't come across as I'm the big entertainer and I'm the center and the reason why you're here, because you're not. If you weren't there, the event would still be going ahead.
Exactly.
And I think there's an element of that as well, is that you just go up and chat with people, really. It is more about just having a chat as much as it is doing the tricks, really. It's difficult one.
And for somebody who's performed at such a high level, and like I said to you before, you've never been short of work. You've always you've always been very, 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 very busy. What do you do to make yourself be memorable, to be remembered? You know, so that those people that have watched you in 6 months' time, when they're considering booking a magician, they come to you as opposed to Google.
I think it's the thing, it's the attitude and the friendliness and the things like that. There's it's the same reason, and I mentioned this just the other day on one of the forums. I think there's something about with some of these people, you become part of the family. You know, I've had some clients that have done, when we did the second DVD set, that was actually for a corporate client on a paid gig.
Oh, wow.
Because I've known them so long and I've done so many things for them, that they were, oh yeah, fine, absolutely no problem at all. And it's, you know, and things like, you know, two or three years ago, I did a silver wedding for a couple whose wedding I did 25 years previous, obviously. And I've done, you know, long service awards for a company long enough to actually be eligible for one. Mm. You know, and I've seen people do be there for the 15-year award and then see them again for their 25th-year award. And it's just a case of people kind of like you. The tricks impress everybody, but they sort of get on with you. You know, you're not too pushy, you're not too arrogant, you're not too demanding, you'll fit in with whatever needed. If there is a problem, and that's one of the things I learned from doing the restaurants over the years, is you make it clear to staff and everybody else that if there's ever a problem, that you know, and you go and hold that table, you keep them occupied, you calm things down, you settle that table down. If there's a problem with hotels that you work at regularly, but dining staff, you don't worry, I'll go and keep that table busy for a bit and just have a chat with them. And they won't know that 10 minutes has gone by because there's been a problem because somebody dropped something in the kitchen. And I think it's that, the other aspects of that is part of it. It's just, I think people, plus of course, it's from the point of view of if it's a booker of different events, it's being reliable. You always turn up, you always do the job, you always look the part, you always, it's because they're the ones that are going to book you more often than individuals. Although, you know, some people have done lots of things for over the years. And I think it's that's what it is. You know, I'm kind of, some of my people are retiring now. You know, they're all going, but mine, I'm heading that way myself now. But it's that's the thing, is you sort of become part of the family, really, I think, with a lot of these things. And that's how you keep getting rebooked.
Yeah.
How you do that, I think, is just by being a sort of fairly reasonably pleasant human being.
Yeah.
I think. Absolutely. As much as anything else.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about creativity, because obviously we've talked about your career as a performer, but you've had a career for many, many years as a lecturer and as a creator of magic. Mm. I remember you, that Mark Leveridge did those close-up symposiums.
Yeah.
You were involved in quite a few of those, weren't you?
I did the second one, I think, because that was just before I did the competition in the States. So it was just like a longer version of the same act. And I did one with Pete Wardell. We did the one that was a kind of a small sort of seminar-based one, I think.
I remember.
But it kind of goes with the territory. I don't make things to sell at all. I don't produce that kind of material. I do stuff that I think is interesting and different. But then again, that also comes from growing up in a place where I didn't have access to, I had books and I could make things up from when people let me old copies of ABBA, I could make props up and learn how to do it. One of the fun things I had as a kid was looking at the old magic catalogues and trying to work out how things were done. from the descriptions. And in those days, a lot of it was, it's not done with threads, it's not done with magnets, and it's not done with mirrors, so you can, well, I can work out what's left now, then it's not that hard. But there was part of it was that. But then again, you see, when I was a student, I did a thesis on one on critical thinking to and problem solving, and one on creativity and creativity techniques. And back in those days, there was almost nothing available in print apart from De Bono and one or two, I think. Big New Pietrzynski had a book, I think. But there's now so much available out there. And I did a course, we did a one-day course a few years ago with a comedian caricaturist friend on comedy and creativity. Mm-hmm. And using all the ideas to kickstart creative thoughts. And a lot of those techniques are really useful when you're doing it. I personally actually think, on the creativity tools front, that the one in Fitzkey, in the trick brain, with the prop, the technique and the effect, where you put them all together and just deal, you know, and randomly assign them and try and work them out, is one of the earliest creativity tools that were published. It's before Osborne and brainstorming. But there's lots of techniques which you can use. And I would say to anybody to look at things like Whack on the Side of the Head, Roger Van Eyck, and there's lots of books on creativity techniques now that can kickstart you things. And you can do, and Jeff McBride's written quite a few of these sort of things as well, that you know, where you just knock your brain out of its normal thing. For me, in recent years, it's always been the corporate promotional shows, because I kind of stopped doing as many trade shows because my back wasn't so good. And then I find there's companies that I've done, like there's an AV company I did loads for over the years. And they have a very, very jargon-heavy industry. So when they do these training days and these trying to familiarise people with the new gear and all that, I would go and do 10, 15-minute spot. I would entertain them over lunch as well, but I'd do a 10, 15-minute spot in the morning with what I like to refer to as visual metaphors for what they're doing. So deconstructing a video signal became like some Heath Robinson device where you pour water into a thing and it separates it into red, yellow, green, and blue, like the old water to wine. I've done signal leakage in unshielded twisted pair cables that's Daryl's jumping knot. So you twist the two and part of the white knot jumps onto the red rope. So that's the signal leakage. And these sorts of things is you do need to just put yourself in an odd space and to generate hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ideas.
Yeah.
And I do the some of the mind mapping type techniques for those. And literally I will put, and it doesn't matter how many ideas and you can't be too judgmental. Doesn't matter how many ideas you make, one is all you need to use.
Yeah.
So you can generate hundreds and hundreds of ideas. And I did a talk for some of the juniors at the Northern a few years ago, saying about how doing a competition act like that, and we put an act together that way between us as a group, you know. And it is because I'm a teacher, qualified as a teacher, I'm used to doing these sort of things. But you start with a theme, and then you do go outward from that theme, and then you go out from those sub themes, and then you kind of connect them back to one another. And that's how you do it. When it comes to creating commercial magic that I perform, that's a bit different. That's not the same way as creating the ideas for specialist shows like that. Yeah. When I do that, when I'm creating that, that's because I've got a. I just have an idea that, and then I start going sideways with it. I'm just generating other possible outcomes from it. Mm. So it's yeah. See, one came about with the one of the Facebook groups, and they said, "Well, we've got a challenge for everybody to learn something that's so out of your comfort zone it's untrue." So everybody's learning. Rings, zombie, whatever. Well, I'm thinking, well, that's cheating because I started out that way. So I'll work out a walk around card set that hasn't got any sleight of hand in it at all, because that's about as alien to me as it's possible to get. Yeah. And it took me ages to do it, but I came up with something that I actually do use quite regularly now. So, because it was a challenge.
Yeah.
That's why. It was just something, like I say, that the Progressive Coin Assembly, I'd never seen anybody do one. So that's why. There's no real, just well, you realise when you do some of these things why you've never seen one done before, because it was a stupid idea in the first place, really, or it's far too difficult to do, or whatever it is. But then you get something that springboards you onto something else, you know.
Mm.
That's what I think, anyway.
That's really good. That's really good advice. It really, It really is. How did your DVD set come about with RSVP, with Russ Stevens? Because obviously, and I've said it off camera, and I'll say it again now, anybody who's watching this, I know we're going to be talking about books and things in a minute, which is amazing, but anybody who's watching this should immediately rush out and get your DVD sets, because they are incredible. And I told you off camera, what was great about them is it was almost like a masterclass in how to perform commercial close-up magic. Well, you were in a real-world environment,
yeah.
And you weren't just like, here's a trick, here's a trick. It was like, well, let me explain why this works, and let me explain about the angles. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. I think it came about, I think Russ was hadn't done that. He'd done a couple, I think, at that point. And it just seemed like it was a good time to do it, to do some of the material, really, because I hadn't done any lectures for a while, and I hadn't done anything like that, and I haven't, you know, really put anything out to the real world. And we ended up, the pub we filmed the first one in was in the village where I grew up. Oh, wow. And nobody had seen me perform for 20 odd years by then, something like that. But by then, because I went full time in 86, and that came out in 2004. So I've been doing it for a long enough time anyway to have a lot of material. And I picked the things that I thought were interesting and different enough to do. And there's reasons why all of them, because they've all evolved being done for real people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think you need to be flexible. When you set out with when you perform the routine, when you first got it, you don't know what shape it's really going to be. And sometimes it ends up something completely different from what you set it out to be. Because you realize, I have a routine that I originally designed for Chris Congreve's Card and Lighter. Mm-hmm. And then realized actually that it worked better in the card case. And so all the effort I'd gone to work out a routine for Chris's brilliant prop was now a completely different routine. And I think that's kind of the point. How it came about, I think it was just the right time to do that one. And Russ wanted to do something. And because also Russ was doing it in the real world, which wasn't all that common back in the first place then. And I kind of wanted it to be done that way, not like the old Stevens videos were with the tame audience, you know. Much as I enjoyed Paul Harris and Mr. Hand, you know, that wasn't quite that's what I grew up watching all those on VHS, and it kind of just seemed right to do it then. And so I picked a lot of what was material either that I'd been in magazines or I'd had it published in other places, and it seemed like the right stuff to do. The second one, it was just logical to do the next one, but that one, as I say, we had two goes trying to do the material for it. Russ has had some terrible nightmare gigs with us. Again, with Harry, when Harry was doing one of his, and Russ was filming it, and we were doing the Adelphi in Liverpool. And it was for student event organisers.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're just doing pre-dinner. That's all. So we go into this, and it's a huge room in the Adelphi. And they got us, they got caricaturists, because my brother was doing one of those, and they got crazy waiters. So we go into the room. The crazy waiters are pulling their hair out because the beer's all free and there's nothing for them to walk around and do, just in bottles. They turn all the lights down so the caricaturists can't see what they're doing. They start doing sections from Chicago on the riser at the front of the room, with all the full-on music, so we can't be seen or heard. So Russ turns to us and goes, "Are all your gigs like this?" And we went, "Yeah, pretty much. That's kind of the way it is." So he and Harry went downstairs to work at a wedding that wasn't, just to try and get some footage. It wasn't the one Harry was supposed to be working at, because we couldn't do anything upstairs in the actual gig. And so some of these things so when we did the second one of mine, we tried two gigs that didn't work. And then we did that one because I'd worked for that company so many times. And the interesting thing for that one is it was an international audience. So it made it a bit more of a challenge to film it because they were from all over Europe. Mm. So it was quite good fun to do. But it was nice to do some of the things that so we literally said, if you want to just come stand outside and then watch some of the other bits and pieces. Yeah, great, we'll come and do that. And so that and it just became a whole thing for the rest of the night. And it was just, but again, it's because it's the people I chat to, you know what I mean? That's why the DVDs are like that. I think about everything the way it's performed because I think about everything the way it's performed. I don't like bad angles. I don't like tables. I don't like reset. I don't like, you know, I've got a problem because if it's got those problems with it, I won't use it or I'll rarely use it. And if I use it rarely, I want it to be simple enough for me to remember. That's the other thing. So hence my chop cup routine with the dice is not hard to remember because I don't do it all the time because it's table surface. But when I do, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, it was just simply the right time to make them, really. It's quite fun. So, yeah.
And since those DVDs, you've not really released anything.
No.
But now, you've kind of alluded to it earlier, but a little birdie has told me that the news on the grapevine is that you're going to be writing your own book. Is that right?
I mooted it a few years ago and started writing one or two things down and you know, I'm digging out old lecture notes and rewriting stuff and things like that. And then last year, but we've lost a year, the year before last. I did a lecture for Blackpool and I decided to do something different from what I was going to do because I've been having some problems with my hands in recent years. I've got degenerative issue with discs in my neck and I've got radiculopathy, they call it. So it affects all the nerves and moves my hands. I've lost a lot of the fine motor control in my left hand and some of the pressure techniques, you know, so things like a riffle pass, I can't do a proper pass anymore. Wow. Soft slights are fine, you know, and I keep it in trim by doing card productions because that makes my hands work hard. But so instead I did for them a lecture and a set of lecture notes with a lot of the almost self-working material that I've come out with over the years. Because I still play with these things, even if they're not my immediate go-to. And some of them I do use, when, you know, when you go back to a table and do something again, there's a lot of my using those kind of scenarios. And so during the course of I've been gradually putting things together. And then the last year or so, I've been writing things up quite consistently now. I've still got all the photographs and everything to do, but rewritten a lot of old routines and written up a lot of routines that have never been published and never been in lecture notes or anything else. So I'm aiming on doing something soon.
So when is it coming out? Are you self-publishing it or are you going through a...
I haven't got as organised as that yet. I have talked to a couple of publishers and I have, you know, spoken to people that have published their own and see how we get on. But I've got a lot of what I'm doing, because I did a project a few years ago that I didn't ever get around to publishing, about doing the corporate promotional stuff and trade shows and all that sorts of things. And then because the world sort of changed and I stopped doing them, I thought, well, it'll be out of date now anyway, that kind of material. But I've got a lot of essays on that sort of side of things as well that I want to kind of think about including. So it's a case of picking what fits with what and what goes in, and whether we do it all in one go or more than one publication, I don't know yet.
Yeah, well, that's the other question I was going to say, is how much material is it going to be? Is it going to be a Roth book? Is it going to be a Roth style book? Or is it going to be a Super Magic style book? Or
I think we're talking 100 odd routines, something like that. So, yeah, something of that order anyway. So I know I've got a couple of people looking over the ones of, I think I've sent about 40 just regular deck routines. Mm-hmm. To have a look at and see which. Well, you see, this is it. I go through fits and starts of producing stuff. Sometimes I just get into a zone and I'll wake up in the middle of the night and the most of the routine's there. You know, if I've had a bad night and I'm lying awake and I'll wake up, and by the morning most of it is in a rough enough shape to, you know, it's workable. Yeah. You know, it'll be performable, but it will work as a routine. And then the other thing is, because I did the same place for Christmas for so many years, to the point where I was seeing people come back that I'd seen as kids 20 years previously, and now they're bringing their own kids. So every year I had three or four new routines for them. And by the time you've done the whole of the Christmas run, it's worked itself into being, you know, a commercial routine. And some of them stayed in my working set, some of them didn't. Some of them go into the you know, they all work, but they may be too similar to something else, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got quite a lot of material, really. And I'm still making stuff up as I go along now.
I was going to say, is there going to be any routines or information on stage magic or manipulation or going back to...
Thought about that. That's a bit more difficult, really. I would like to do some stuff because I've got some work on jumbo coins that I don't think has been anywhere else. And I've got a lot of things that I've just done for myself because I like to keep my eye in on what everybody else is doing. And I have this thing ever since I saw Vito Lupo do an act many years ago when he was doing the mime act. And it was everything transformed into everything else. It was beautiful. There was just, and that became a sort of a halfway theme for many of us that were Jeff McBride influenced and J. Scott Berry and people like that, you know, that we all saw that and wanted to do that. So I've played with a lot of things of transition work. So I've done, you know, so jumbo coin to thimble and jumbo coin to minute wand and minute wand to ball. But whether they're of any use, I don't know. I hesitated. I've got an Interlock production, which basically produces four blackjack hands. And it's quite cool, but I didn't know whether to just do commercial stuff at this point, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It would be nice to go through some of the original bits of the old props from the act, I think, as well. Because I still have all that. I have everything. I'm a terrible hoarder for stuff.
Well, you know, it could be a book where you've got stories and theory and not just routines, but absolutely everything. I think that you have so much knowledge and you've been around and seen so many different scenarios. It'd be great to see.
Yeah. I know. So somebody said in one of the Facebook groups about, you know, what's your worst gig? And I'm kind of going, how many would you like? I can give you dozens. If you do enough over the years, you know, do you want the one where somebody died? That was quite a good one at the gig.
What?
Yeah, they don't really want to see card tricks after that, you know. And then I've had ones where I was I think you can forget about doing the stand up now because the police are on the way because everybody's busy having a fight in the car park. That was a good one. And then one of the classic ones is where I walked into a gig and go up to the first bloke that you go up to in the first group, takes a card, takes it out of the deck, folds it up and eats it. Just eats it, swallows it. Down, and me and the other people that were just stood there, I just wet myself laughing. The best thing was I did the same gig the following year, and the moment I walked in, this woman goes to me and says, "You know that bloke that ate the card last year? He's not here this year, so we'll have a good time." And I'm thinking, and that's all that was remembered was this bloke. Just literally, there's nowhere in any of the books does it tell you there's an out for that. Just, I'll take a card, I'll look at it, I'll fold it up, and I'll just eat it and swallow it. And I'm just looking at it going, "What did you do?"
That's crazy. I think that when you've had a certain amount of experience, you've seen some stuff that a lot of people just won't believe.
Yeah. Well, you'll know. You don't talk to other working performers about the good shows because they're the normal ones.
Oh yeah.
You talk about the ones where someone went hideously wrong and you managed to just about get away with it. Usually, some absolute nightmare scenario when you just coped somehow.
I remember being booked to do a stand-up show at a corporate thing, and it was for all of their staff. There was about 300 people in the audience, and the MD was having a chat beforehand. He was going on stage and talking about stuff, and he just casually mentioned at the end that he was laying off 25% of the workforce on Monday.
Yes, done that.
Right. Just 25% of the workforce, and we'll be reaching out to you on Monday. And by the way, here he is, the magician.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah, we did a walk around one in Southport, and I'm sorry, but the company's been wound down, so you'll all be made redundant. So enjoy the night. And we had to walk around doing card tricks for 2 hours. Just see, these are the things that nobody prepares you for, yeah. And you can't really be prepared for other than the fact that you've just done enough. You go, oh no, what am I going to do now? Mm-hmm. Get my way through it. I've got an absolute gem. If you want to hear it, it was between somewhere. The miscommunication was between the booker of the actual group that were coming to the hotel who was a regular one we worked at, the agent who they got in touch with and contacted me, and it was Christmas Day, right? And I turn up to do this gig, and I've got my close-up case, and this lady who was the original organizer of the event, came and said, I don't want that thing where you go on the tells. I just want the show at the end of lunch, thank you. And it's like all these, you know, saga people thing. And I'm going, right, well, my show at the end of lunch is 60 miles away. It's at home. I'm thinking it's not here. So we don't want you going around the tables. I don't like that. Right. It's Christmas Day. So there's no shops open. Can't go and buy anything. So I literally went through my case to find anything that I could do a stand-up act with. Borrowed, you know, lemon from behind the bar and, you know, and some envelopes and literally that sort of thing. Did the folded writing down. But that's literally it. So I put together a 20-minute stand-up act with what was in the case and what I could scan from behind the bar. And at the end of the day, fine, great, round of applause. And then the booker lady came up to me and said, that was absolutely brilliant, just what I was looking for. It was like real magic, no magician's props and anything like that. Fantastic, it's just what we wanted. And I'm thinking, if only you'd known. I have no idea. I'm literally making up a stand-up act as I'm going along, from bits I could remember from the years gone by.
Oh, my gosh. That was
fun. That was I wouldn't do that again.
What you've just said there, that's the attitude that I think that people need to learn when they first come into this industry and they decide they want to be a professional, whether it's be a semi-professional, professional. What you just said there, that was fun. I think you need to look at every situation and just go, well, you know, look at the bright side to every situation. If you're kind of constantly going, oh my gosh, this was terrible and this was terrible.
Yeah.
You're not going to last in the industry very long.
No, you're not. No, I mean, so many times when we did the trade shows, it wasn't right, wing it, lads. You got to, when we did it, because how that used to work was, because I used to work with my colleague, John, who was a human statue. Right. And we were built into the stand. So John would be a mannequin on his plinth with a cable coming off it that was like gaffer to the ground, like it was all real and fully, and he'd be dressed with whatever was appropriate for the company we were working for. And I'd hook people and build the crowd and do the qualifying questions so stand staff could see who were the right people. And then we would get to the point where we would go, right, so, but wouldn't it be good if you knew what your clients needed before they did? Well, here at XYZ, we think we've got that cracked. So if you can just remember the card, they'd step forward. If you press the red button, John would have a big red button on the plinth next to him. They press the red button, and as they got to press the red button, he'd suddenly come to life, grab him by the wrist and go, 4 o'clock. And then they just go straight up in the air. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, that's the entertainment. But if you're interested, and we pre-qualified the crowd anyway, put them on the stand and the machine, you know, and it worked. We did one in Sweden for a motor show, and it turned out it didn't work that way because they wouldn't stop for me. They don't like that. So we had to swap it around and put the mime at the front and bring me in later on once they come onto the stand. So we had to make it up as we're going along, literally. But yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that as a machine. That's how I met my wife doing the trade show doing that as well.
Really?
Yeah. We were at the NEC. We were doing, John, I think, was a French chef on that one. It was a cake decorating company that we were working for. And they'd put us in a hall that did greetings cards, which made sense. But it turned out it was too much of a thoroughfare for everybody else coming through the trade show. So there was I stopped somebody that repaired steam locomotives for a living and, you know, and somebody that was a mail order catalogue for beekeepers and something. So it wasn't really any good to them. So I just said, look, never mind about getting new clients. It's not going to work. It's the wrong stand, wrong place. Just get us in the exhibition press. So I started stopping anybody. And then on this particular afternoon, this little lass, all dressed in black, coffin-shaped handbag, long purple hair, she's not going past my stand, so I dragged her back onto the stand to do a card trick. And so, you know, it would be good if you knew what you did before they did here. I think she goes to the button. John comes to life and goes, 4 o'clock. Nothing. Not a flicker of reaction. She turns to him and just goes, do you mind? I'm doing a card trick with him. In all the years we did that, that was the only ever time we had that reaction. And then I ran into a social event in Manchester from a different trade show a few weeks later, and we'll be married 20 years this year. It was just the most unique response that I've ever seen in all the years we did that.
Crazy. That's mad.
Yeah, that was quite cool.
Well,
she's a bit odd.
That's just crazy. Right, well, let me ask you one more question, because it's been an incredible interview. And before we wrap it all up, I want to ask you one more question, which is, what's next for you, Sean? And this is a question I ask everyone I interview, but Your legacy is set. You are so well known for many different reasons. One, for everything that you've done through your very long career and competitions and lecturing and creations, but also you are very active on the online community. Like, you're very active in various different Facebook groups, and a lot of people who are in a completely different country know of you and value your advice and your guidance, which you give freely in all these different groups, which is wonderful, even though they might not have ever seen you perform. You've mentioned that you've got the book coming out. Is there anything left on your magical bucket list that you want to hit? You've done it all.
That's a good question. Yeah. I know, tick that off, tick that off. I think I'm probably going to settle to doing, because there's a limit to the kind of stuff I'm going to be able to perform going forward. I know that that's the case. You know, we have to wait and see what neurosurgeons say and all that sort of thing. But I think I'm more likely to settle down to creating things that are less practical, but I would like to do, you know, that don't have to be, because I've tied myself so much. As I go back and I look at, you know, when somebody asks about what's in such and such a book, and I'll get it off the shelf and have a look at it, and because I do that for references for people for a lot of things. And I look at it and I go, do you know, that's an absolutely brilliant routine. But I glossed over it because it's not, it needs a table. And I think things are changing now such that the things I had glossed over are no longer impossible to do because of things like the Zoom shows and stuff. So I would like to go back and create things of that sort now. That's what I'd like. That's what I think is the way I'm going to be heading now, simply because I've been too restrictive on what I've done. Because if it didn't go from a regular shuffle deck, if it didn't fit in the right pocket it could belong in, if it didn't do instant reset, and there's a long list of things that you would put on normal commercial use material, I've just kind of discarded it, you know. So I haven't investigated lots of plots. There's lots of things I've not even gone down the route of, in particularly in cards and coins, that because of that reason. And I think I would now like to go that way and explore some of those things more, because there is, you know, it's made me realize there is more of a market for things like that than I ever realized. There's more of a commercial use for it than there ever was before. Yeah. And I think that's where I'm aiming on going, I think, now. Plus, I'm always available for advice for anybody that needs it and wants it. That's the other thing. If I've got anything that is worth saying, I'll try and give it. You know, I'll try and help, you know,
well, that's any way I can. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, which is, back in my day, when I first got into magic, and I joined my first magic club, the advice I was given over and over again was find a mentor. Find a mentor. Find somebody that can take you under your wing, under their wing. You don't really see that as much these days. You don't. But what you've done in Facebook groups, what you do and what you continue to do, is as good as, if not better than, for somebody new into magic. What advice would you give them about finding a mentor or finding guidance? Is there a?
Oh, that's very difficult, really, because until you know something about the person, know whether they're worth listening to or match what you want to do, it's really hard to tell. See, I was really fortunate in that aspect, because I sort of grew up doing the competitions and then doing the shows. People would come and give me advice, and sometimes, well, I mean, you know, when it was, I was lucky because it was people like Bobby Bernard and Ali Bongo and Pat Page, and you know Bob Swadling taught me techniques of the Dancing Cane. Rovi, of course, was a absolute godsend for learning the real world. But I kind of think because I listened to what they had to say, they didn't always necessarily give me the right advice for me, but they would tell me what the problem was, and they'd be absolutely bang on the money right. And I think if you're going to do these sort of things, you do need to take on board that when I give people advice, I can only give them what I think is the right advice for me. It might not be the right advice for them, but that probably I've identified something that they need to think about. And I think that's one of the things. Actually, finding a mentor is probably going to be a lot harder. I think by accident, I would say I've had probably three people I'd classify as a mentor. One was, when I first started as a kid, was John Pye, who was later the international president of the IBM, because he was the only magician in the area, and he was very, very tolerant with me getting off the school bus and going into his shop and picking his brains, you know, particularly for a photographer's shop rather than a magic shop, you know what I mean? And then Brian Sefton, who taught me how to do and put up with me a lot with doing the manipulation and put me on the right path for things. And then obviously when I was doing commercial magic role, he was the governor, because I think he showed me how you can entertain real people with literally just a deck of cards and yourself. And I think if you're going to go about finding a mentor, you need to just listen to a lot of people. And if you think somebody gives you the right sort of advice, see if they're approachable. I would say not everybody is, and not everybody has the time. And some people do it commercially, and that's great too. And they'll you know, you pay for lessons, but it depends upon what it needs to be. Something that's, you both get something out of it. I think when I coached Ben Prus for the Young Magician of the Year, it was good for both of us. You know, it was good for me to teach him to do these things again, even though I couldn't necessarily do them in the same way. And it was good for him to learn how I wanted to. And it was nice to see him evolve into doing things that I didn't do.
Yeah.
And that was rewarding for me, you know. And I suspect that's probably why those people gave me the advice when I was young, is because they saw me evolve into somebody that they thought was, you know, because I listened. That's what it was. And I tried my best not to let anybody down. Didn't always work. But, you know, I think that's it. So as for finding a mentor, I think I would say find people that you think, listen to what they have to say when they have something to say. And when they put some advice down for you, if you ask for advice, respond to it. But also ask, particularly on social media, which is harder, you need to ask, you need to explain what kind of advice you're looking for. So one of the things I've said a lot is it helps. If you're putting a video there, are you putting it there for criticism? Are you putting it there just for reference for yourself? Are you putting it there because it's a work in progress? You know, what do you want from it? Yeah. And don't necessarily listen to all the people that say no. Say it's just ignore the people. Don't rise to the people that tell you it's a load of rubbish and you shouldn't be doing it that way. Because you never know. You might have the right way to do it that they haven't thought of yet. Next time will be that the big one, you know, that you'll have broken something new.
That's really great advice. That's really fantastic advice. And this has been a fantastic place to end the interview. Sean, this has been absolutely incredible. Now, if people want to reach out to you, if they've watched this and they want to seek out your advice, what's the best way to contact you? Is it via a Facebook group and tagging you in?
Yeah, probably. It's usually that's the way. I mean, I'm on social media fairly regularly at the moment, and more so than usual.
Which Facebook groups do you?
Magicians Only is the one that we're the admin team for. Right. Obviously, I mean, you know, you can find me through many of the magic ones, but the routine manipulations for the manipulators and for and the circle as well, of course, if you remember. But then you probably don't need my advice if you remember. I would think that's kind of redundant in it by that point. But you know, you can find me on social media. I'm always easy enough to find. On Facebook, you know.
Fantastic. And if people want to register their interest in any book that you might bring out in the future,
if people let me know it might be as easy for some people, because I don't always notice messages on the requests on a normal one, because I get a lot of those to do with the groups and things like that, but maybe via the pages and other things as well. But it's a case of, if you let me know that you are interested, it gives me an idea as to how to approach doing it. And I would say also, I will be sorting a website for it when I get to the point where I'm organized enough to do that, because I hate doing that. That's not a job I relish in any way, shape or form. I'm afraid I date from the days when I wrote the HTML code of the first one. So I'm not really.
Well, I'm telling you right now, you can officially say that, yes, I'll be the first in line for any book that you decide to buy. Literally the first one in line. Please take my money. Absolutely 100%. Sean, this has been an amazing interview. You're an amazing person.
Thank you.
You've done so much for the British magic community, and you continue to do so. And guys, do me a favor. Leave a comment down below. because like Sean says, he is active on social media. So if you leave a comment down below, I'm sure he will see it. Yep. But Sean, one more time, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you once again for asking, mate. It's been great fun.
You're amazing, mate. Guys, don't forget to subscribe to the channel if you want to see more videos like this. Like the video, leave a comment down below, and I'm going to be back again tomorrow with another video. So I'll see you then. Thanks very much. Sean, take care.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel, Magic TV, which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.